Thanks a lot. As you know, I'm Stephen Downs, and I'm from Moncton, New Brunswick, and I'm speaking here at the CAUCE, or how is that pronounced? CAUCE? I got it right. Conference here in Toronto. And if you're wondering why I'm reintroducing myself, it's because I'm recording this talk, and you can't really see it on it, but I've got a neat little, you know, with all the zigzags and up and down. I'm recording it using a free software program called Audacity. And I'll be taking this, saving it as an MP3, and putting it up on my website later on tonight. So I'm not simply giving a talk here. I'm creating a learning resource that I'll be able to share with people around the world later today. And I mention that not simply because I want you to be warned that anything you say will later be used as incriminating evidence. I'm saying that to illustrate that there are changes that are coming to learning, not just to continuing education, although that is, of course, your particular interest, but to learning in general. I'm going to be talking about some of those changes in this talk. So I'd like to thank you all for coming to this. I was a bit surprised to find myself in this room because all the talks are in little smaller rooms. So I sort of feel like, you know, I'm in talking to a cathedral or something like that. It's not the oddest place I've ever spoken. The oddest place I've ever spoken was in North Bay last year when I spoke in an aircraft hangar at the airport. And there was a big, huge jet engine behind me, and that was a very interesting talk. I'm sure you all saw Wade Davis yesterday, and I'm sure you all appreciated as much as I did his talk. And I found it interesting because there were some themes that he presented yesterday that I find in common today. I'm just going to draw those out ever so briefly. There are two things that I want to pull out of this. And the first is his commitment to his endorsement of diversity, and particularly ethnic and cultural diversity. And by the time we get to the end of this presentation, you'll see that diversity is an important component in my own thinking. But the second point, I think, was a little more subtle, but I think really worth drawing out, and that was the idea of reading the forest, or in the case of the Polynesians, reading the sea. The idea that reading isn't just something that we do with language as we understand it, that reading isn't just simply following a sequence of words in order to understand intentional meaning and semantics and truth values and that. But reading, rather, is a way of seeing or a way of perceiving an environment so that you can infer or understand beyond that which you see immediately in front of yourself. That resonates a lot with what I'm going to be talking about today. And, you know, I'm not going to compare myself with an Amazon Explorer. I'm obviously not an Amazon Explorer. Although I would take any chance to go to South Africa that I could. But there's a sense of comparison in the way he grew up exploring, going, as he said, to the Amazon jungles at a young age. And at about that same age, I began my explorations in the jungle of the online world. And these days, especially if you read the press reports, it's not clear which is more of a jungle. Okay, that's a joke. So-so joke. And so what I'm going to talk about today is also a type of reading, and it's a different type of reading. And the reading of the online world that I'll talk about is as important to my topic as the reading of the forest or the reading of the ocean is to his. And importantly, the same thing is happening. Cognitively, semantically, the same thing is happening. And I really wanted to draw that out. Now, my clock says 2:56. So we're done. What does your clock say? 140? 146. Okay. So and that gives me 45 minutes. Thank you. Philosophy, not math. You don't want to see my math transcripts. Okay. Let's see if this works. They did that yesterday, too, and I was sitting in the back of the room. I thought, wow, it's so coordinated. The lights came down at just the right time. It was just him hitting the switch. The theme of this conference is through the eyes of our students, looking forward. And that's why I wanted to draw on the idea of what it is you see when you look through a computer. And of course, the first thing that we think of when we start thinking of our students and through the eyes of the students and what sort of things they see are the things that are said these days about the net generation, Generation Next, the Millennium Generation, the Digital Generation. There's a whole bunch of different names for this generation. I've given you a couple links at the bottom. One to Don Tapscott and another to the EduCause, Diane Oblinger's book with a number of articles in that on this. These slides will also be available on my website. I'm hoping later today if I have internet access. If I don't, it might take a couple of days. And I'm sure you've probably heard, if not at this conference, then certainly sooner, about some of the features or characteristics of the net generation. I'm just going to talk about them ever so briefly. I don't want to linger on these because it's probably repetition for many of you. The idea of people who have grown up with computers, with the new technology, with things like mobile phones, cell phones, with satellite TV, digital television, MP3 players, they're always connected, they're always online, they have an expectation of an immediate reaction. I remember when I first started on the internet, people used to say, you should answer your emails within 24 hours, and today if you take 24 hours to answer an email, they'll say, what took you so long? You weren't paying attention? Were you offline? How could that happen? The way they approach things is also different. We're used to, if we have new technology or something like that, we'll read the manual or follow the instructions. The net generation will just simply start pushing buttons until it either works or explodes. And either way is fine with them. If you go online and you look around the internet, you'll see very clearly that the net generation is independent. Not so much distrustful as, I don't want to say dismissive either, but one of those two things of authority. Authority just sort of, they're there, but they're not relevant. They're open, they are expressive, they interact, they take things into their own hands, they'll do things for themselves much more than preceding generations will. I'm not used to one of these either. Taking that and relating that to our topic, when we, and by we I'll say the older generation, although I'm sort of not sure which side I fit into, when we look at a computer, we see, and ask yourself if this is not true of yourself, we see things like words and sentences, right? Textual content, paragraphs, articles. We see images and graphics, photographs. Perhaps, depending on the website that we're going to, we'll see video or animations or something like that. In other words, what we see online is to a large degree the same sort of thing we see elsewhere in our lives. Same sort of thing we see in magazines, newspapers, on the television, and so on. Does that sound right to you? Yeah. I want to put it to you that somebody who is immersed in internet culture sees something differently. Sees something different. One way of drawing this out is to think even about what we call this online world. We call it virtual reality. as though what we see online is somehow not real. And some of you may have read the works of Dreyfus, and the whole idea that you have to have a bodily interaction in order for an interaction to be real, that you have to have physical consequences to actions in order for those actions to constitute any sort of risk on your part. And so we tend to characterize the online as though it's some sort of abstraction, some sort of remove from reality. But this is simply a point of view. And as you've already probably read the slide ahead of me, think about what you perceive when you use other technology in order to see things. Think about looking in a mirror. When you wake up in the morning and you stagger to the bedroom, or not the bedroom, the bathroom, never mind. A little autobiography crept in there. And you look in the mirror and you see yourself in the mirror. I know you want to say, or maybe this is more autobiography, that's not real. But it is real, isn't it? The face that you see in the mirror, you understand that that face is yourself and that you indeed exist. You are real. If you look through a telescope at a star, you don't say, well, that's not really a star that I'm seeing. You say it's real. You call up your friend on the telephone. And you wouldn't think that your interaction with the person over the telephone is somehow less real simply because it's on the telephone. You know that you are speaking with a real person on the telephone. Well, for somebody who has grown up with computers, this reality extends to the online world. And, you know, I'll speak of my own experience. As I was chatting just beforehand about my own background in this area. And, you know, I started off, actually I was chatting at lunch, not with you. I'm sorry, I confused things. I started off in a technological environment. My father worked for Bell Canada. So I sort of went into the internet almost as soon as it was created. And one of the things that I went into was something called a MUD. How many of you have heard of a MUD? Right, maybe about a fifth of you. A MUD stands for Multi-User Dungeon. And so that's a very wholesome activity to be into. And what that is an online game. It's completely text-based. You log on to it, and you'll access a server somewhere out there on the internet. The one I usually went to was based at the University of Florida. It was called Mud Dog. And you're logged onto this thing, and you interact just by typing text commands, and you see lines of text come up. And it's a game. And the object of the game is to explore through different rooms, kill monsters, collect treasure, and advance through different levels until you become a wizard. Now, what makes it really neat is that in this environment, you are not alone. As you go from room to room, you will meet other people who have logged in elsewhere, you know, from anywhere in the world pretty well. So we had people from Australia, people from the States, people from England, wherever. And it's funny because they were represented only as lines of text on a screen, but you knew that they were real. Well, mostly real. Sometimes there are things called mobs, mobile objects, which were monsters that pretended to be people and then would kill you. but the point that I'm getting at here is that when you access this sort of environment and you do it, you know, just as a matter of course over a matter number of years or decades, your interactions with those people online are just as real as your interactions with people on the telephone or with yourself over a mirror. And that's what we're seeing of the internet today. I've tried to draw that out with this comparison here. If any of you were video conferencing, this is a technology that you're familiar with because it's a lot like the television, you wouldn't really doubt that the people on the other side of that video conference are real. You know, but in a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, that's what that long abbreviation stands for, where you're seeing animations or cartoon representations of people, you might be inclined to think, well, wait, no, this is fake. But people who are used to this environment know and interact and behave and believe that these are indeed real people. And that's the type of interaction that's happening. Now, the neat thing about this is, if you give me that, then I can move to the next step, which is to say, websites are people too. And when you go to a website, a personal website, a blog, whatever, what you are seeing is just as real as one of these online role-playing games, as a video conference, as your own face in the mirror. That's the point of view. It is well known and very well documented by now that the next generation creates its own media. And I'm going to linger on that a little bit because it's an important point. I want to talk a bit about what is happening when the next generation creates its own media. In either this paper or another paper that I refer to in the next page or so, it was said that, 78 million profiles have been created on MySpace. To give you a perspective of what that's like, I was giving a talk in in Edson, Alberta, and we went to check and see if the people in their class were on MySpace, and we checked, we looked it up by high school, and it turned out basically all of their senior class was on MySpace. I had no idea, no clue. They're up looking at, you know, pictures of their students in this MySpace environment. And what's happening, and Dana Boyd observes this, and she's drawing from people like Sherry Turkle and others who have studied this online environment, that people are using this environment to create their own digital identities. And Boyd says, the dynamics of identity production play out visibly on MySpace. Profiles are digital bodies, public displays of identity, where people can explore impression management. We see so much user-created or user-generated content online. Blogs is another thing. I'm actually going to a blogging conference in just a few days, an educational blogging conference. And blogs, again, there are tens of millions, possibly 100 million blogs out there as well. And for those of you who are not familiar, a blog is a website with a sequence of entries where the entry from the most recent date is posted at the top. That's all a blog is. And what makes a blog interesting, what makes the phenomenon of blogging interesting, is that people are very easily able to create their own online content. And blogs began, they sort of resemble personal diaries or journals. But as time has gone by, they've become much more than that. And now people are uploading photographs and all of that into their blogs as well. My newsletter, OL Daily, which was mentioned in the introduction, is widely characterized as a blog. Now, I still continue to refer to it as my newsletter. That's a bit of a conceit on my own part, because I began the newsletter before blogging became popular, and I called it a newsletter when I started, and I kept calling it a newsletter. But strictly speaking, it is a blog. It's dated entries. I do entries basically every day, and I link to resources, and I comment to them and comment about them in the manner of your typical blog. User-generated content isn't restricted to blogging. There's also something called Wikipedia, and let me ask, how many of you are familiar with Wikipedia? Pretty much everyone, so I don't need to linger on this, except to note that this kind of content is more widely used than traditional content like Britannica, and as of course you've probably heard about the Nature study that finds the two types of resource to be roughly equal in accuracy. I keep putting this down. That's probably just as well. Otherwise, I'd play with it. Making their own media. People are creating their own photographs and posting them online. In some of these talks, what I've done is actually take a photograph of the audience and upload it during the talk, because it's kind of a neat thing to do. But we've got a slightly different setup here. And some people began to object. They didn't want to be photographed anyhow. Podcasting, which is the uploading of audio content. That's what I'll be doing with this talk. I'll be taking this audio file that I'm creating, I'll be uploading it to my website. That's podcasting. And again, anyone around the world will be able to access this. I've listed a few sites there that, if you don't know a whole lot about how to do audio, these sites do all of the technical work for you. And basically all you do is speak into the microphone, or with audio, you can just call it up. You can quite literally call in on the telephone your audio blog post. So iPod or audio, Liberated Syndication is a place that hosts podcasts. YouTube has become huge recently. It's user-created video. I just want to pop into that site. As you can see from the green, we planned this. Are we going to pop in? Yes, we are. Okay. And, where do we want to go? Let's just scroll down a wee bit. Is that skating one still there? Yeah. Okay. Let's go into that street. It's short. And what I'm pointing out here, and maybe not quite so loud. Okay. Now, you might think this is really silly, and it is really silly, and that was it. I just picked that one at random because that was on the front page of YouTube. But if you go to YouTube, it becomes addictive. Trust me, it becomes addictive. And at least as entertaining as commercial professional television. And what's happening is more and more people are creating and uploading their own video entertainment. And as a trend, and this is a trend that is evident across the board, people who consume media are replacing the producers. People are producing their own media. And so they interact with this media, they view this media a different way. They see it not simply as content which is presented to you to be consumed, but they see it as a representation of the creator. That's why when you read about blogs, and I linked to my own paper, Educational Blogging, but many other people have made the same observation. When you read about blogs, one of the characteristics of a blog is that it's a personal voice, a first-person singular voice. I think this, I think that, I saw such and such, I gave such and such a talk. And a blog, therefore, is not simply a recitation of facts. It's not simply an expression of something that happened, but it's also a representation of the person who wrote the blog. That's why I hear this comment a lot. When I write my newsletter, I write my newsletter in this first-person style, and people read the newsletter, and they learn about the news, but they also learn about me. And it struck me as kind of surprising at first when I'm used to it. That's the way they prefer it. They want it to be that way. They want to know about the person who's giving them the news, because it gives them context or a framework from which to understand what is being presented. Very important. Now, taking these thoughts, I want you to think about, to create a mental image for yourself about what you see when you go to a website. Can you hit that link, please? Now, picture yourself, you've gone to my website, and he's going to type in the address here. So, you go to my website, And forget about the semantical content that is being presented to you. Forget about the meaning, the truth values, the sentences, the words. And visualize what happens. Get it? Not nothing. Explore page after page after page after page. And you get this three-dimensional linked presentation in front of you. This is what is happening in your mind as you explore my website. What you're seeing on that screen is a graphical representation of my website. And the blue links, the blue dots are links to other pages, and the lines are things connecting them to my pages, and then there's the divs and the images and the other elements of my pages, even some tables, I'm sad to say. Oh well. And what's happening here is that one thing after another, after another, after another is being connected for you in your mind. And the connections between the resources are as important as the resources themselves. That's why when I do my newsletter, I just do some quick descriptions and links, because the idea is to create the connections rather than to try to reproduce the semantical content of what's out there. I want to point you to it and connect it to something else to show why it's important. And I'm showing you why it's important to me, but by inference, it might be important to you. Okay, let's kill that. I told him I'd say, kill that. What we have online is fundamentally different from what we used to have. And when people who grow up with online technology like the internet read, they are doing something different than we do when we read. And I use we a little bit, well, inaccurately here, because, you know, like I said, I have a foot in both worlds, so I kind of see this hyperdimensional thing, I kind of see this linear thing. I've always been bad at linear, so for me it was a nice escape. Traditional media is linear. Hypermedia, as we've just seen, is multidimensional. Traditional media is composed. This is really important, particularly if you're thinking about how learning resources are constructed. Think about those of you who have worked in learning objects and course design, how a course is composed of different pieces, packages, learning resources, images, tests, etc. Hypermedia is not composed, it is connected. There's a different approach, a different way of thinking of resources. Traditional media describes. Sentences have semantical import. Sentences derive their truth value from the accuracy with which they describe external reality. Tarski's theory of truth. Snow is white is true if and only if snow is white. Hypermedia doesn't describe, it represents, it stands for, it becomes an icon, a sign, like the waves that we saw in the Polynesian environment. The waves don't have truth values, they represent, they're a consequence of. There's a causal relation between the thing that created it and the sentence that is being understood. Traditional media is static. Look at that image. That's as static as you can get. Hypermedia is dynamic. Here today, gone tomorrow. That's why, for this talk, it's important for me to talk about the talk that you heard yesterday and bring that right into this context. That talk didn't exist 2 days ago. But without that talk, this talk isn't possible. There's a connection and a relation between that talk and this talk, which is captured if you're thinking hypermedially. I don't know if that's a word. Oh well, too late now. That you miss if you're thinking static. I come to these conferences and people say, yeah, please send your presentation ahead of time. And I respond to them, I might be able to give you a title, maybe. But the idea here is that the media The content is dynamic. It has quite literally a different meaning today, tomorrow, the next day. People who hear this talk and see these slides online will have a different experience of this content than you're having now. Just needed a sip of coffee there. I'm sort of looking at this recording. I do hope it's loud enough, but I should shout into it and give everybody online like a fright. I like doing that to people, although I do it usually accidentally. Think about now what's happening. I mentioned this before. These networked technologies, hypermedia, are used to create, as Misa Matsuda says, full-time intimate communities, sometimes thought of as intentional communities, communities we form deliberately, communities that allow us to create networks of relationships not based on accidents of geography, religion, language, but rather based on shared and identified common interests or common causes. The demonstrations in Seattle or the demonstrations in the Philippines against the government, organized by networks of people working together online in order to form a community in order to undertake an action. You may have heard of the phenomenon of flash mobs, which is, you know, kind of a fun sort of instantiation of the same sort of thing. A network of people who don't know each other will get together and show up somewhere. One of the YouTube things, and there's a whole website that devoted to this now, a bunch of people, they didn't know each other, but they got together. They all wore blue shirts that looked exactly like the shirts worn by employees of, and I forget what the store was. Pardon? Best Buy, that's it. And so they all went into this Best Buy store and stood at the end of the aisle. So a customer walks in, it looks like there's 500 staff people in the store. And they would help the customers. And you can sort of see how disruptive that is. But that's the sort of thing. And stuff like that, I cannot emphasize this enough. Stuff like that is happening almost daily out there as people are organizing this. Their sense of humor is really something else. And I'm not sure where to go with this. And I was just thinking this yesterday as I listened to Wade Davis's talk, because he's talking about the death of culture, and I think that's a good point. I certainly agree with his point that there is a value and a need to preserve the diversity of culture and to preserve, as he says quite accurately, the wisdom of our ancestors. But I'm also online and I'm watching almost daily the birth of 1,000 new cultures as these different groups of people get together. The edubloggers is a certain sort of culture. The webheads are another culture dedicated, again, to the use of the web for learning and language learning. And I could go on and on and on. Thousands of these little micro-cultures are growing up. They grow up, they blossom, they live their life, they die, and it just becomes this proliferation of cultures and online. And this is important because culture is intimately tied to identity. People ask you who you are, what you are. If someone asks me what I am, I'm not going to say, well, I'm human, because, well, it kind of goes without saying, usually. But I'll say something like, I'm Canadian, or I'm English, or whatever my religion is, etc. I'll express myself, say what I am with relation to my culture. Now, what are you? Well, I'm a wizard at the fourth level in the realm of Gorg. And in some circles, that makes a lot of sense. I had for the longest time my alter ego, Labatt the Cat, the senior wizard. I was as proud to be a senior wizard on Mud Dog as I am to be a senior researcher at NRC. The level of accomplishment to me felt about the same. Different realities. A person's website is a representation, and it's a representation of the links that this person forms to the rest of the community. When you looked at my website, we've already said that my website is a presentation of myself, my website is a presentation of my identity, but my website, as you saw with that graphic, is a web of connections to other people, other things. All these resources that I connect to through my newsletter, all these people that I talk about, all these people that I write about and who write about me. When I'm presenting myself, I am presenting my network. Myself is my network. My network is myself. Think of, I asked, what do you see when you look through a computer? From McLuhan's, our perceptions, our communications, are extensions of ourselves, facets of our identity. Imagine your interaction with your computer as though you had recorded it. Now, you haven't. Well, you have, but it's hidden away in your logs, and you probably don't look at that a whole lot. But imagine that you were creating a website of all the things that you looked at. That website would be your network, wouldn't it? And as you look through your computer at all of these different sites, you are creating a dynamic, non-static network of connections, social network. In other words, you are creating a non-static, dynamic network version of your own identity. Or, as you've probably looked ahead on the slide, I never could time these things. When you look at the computer, what you are seeing is yourself reflected back as though through a mirror. Now, how does that happen? Because you have the capacity of choice. You are autonomous. You are connected to the rest of the world. You have the ability, the capacity to go read these other sites, and you have the capacity to form these connections, to interact with these connections. In other words, when you are interacting with your computer, using your computer, you have all of the properties of a node in a successful network. And it's those properties that allow you to define your identity in this way. Now, why is this important? It's important because it changes what you do. As people who facilitate educational opportunities. Now, I work mostly in online learning, and therefore in distance learning, although that's becoming a bit more of a blur every day as the online becomes part of the in-class and the in-class becomes part of the online and it all mooshes together, which is good. But what that means is, insofar as we use this technology in learning, our theories of, or our approach to, online learning and distance learning, first of all, must capture the expression of self as a network of connections. When you're using the computer to learn, your identity becomes enmeshed or embedded in this learning. What else could happen, right? And secondly, because of the nature of your interaction, you have to place yourself, the learner, at the center of this learning experience. And so with a hop, skip, and a jump, I'm into learner-centeredness. Okay, well, not quite like that. Because there are many ways to go to learner-centeredness. But there are certain ways in which it's approached in this online environment. Let's take, for example, excuse me. And I could use different examples, but this one's fun. I like Terry. So Anderson and Garrison and Rourke's community of inquiry model. And the point of this model is to emphasize the importance not simply of interaction but of actual presence. And they identify three major types of presence: social presence, cognitive presence, teaching presence. And where they interact, that creates the educational experience. And you think of, you know, the classmates, the book, the tutoring or the instruction, all of these things blending together to create the educational experience. And that's the theory of learning design in a distance or online learning environment. And obviously I'm glossing it, but there's a link there. First step is, it's not simply presence, but rather social network, cognitive network, teaching network. So the presence really and actually is this set of connections to other things. It's not simply a presence. There needs to be these connections to these other things. And also, if you think about it, you know, they put down in the middle, like, educational experience. In the typical university, college, continuing education universe, that educational experience is the course. But that educational experience changes on this model from being the course to being the self, the learner, not the course. The locus of learning is in the learner, not in the course. Now, many people have said that, but this is why that's important, because the self is at the center of this network. Here is the network. This network looks just like the website. It looks just like a social network and social network analysis. It looks like the thing that we saw. We can see the self in the center, but the self is distributed across all of those connections with the friends, with the materials, with any instructors. Technologically, it looks like that. How many of you have seen this diagram before? Excellent. Nobody. This is what comes after the learning management system. This is what makes the learning management system obsolete. The diagram itself was created by someone called Scott Wilson. He works with CETUS in Britain. I would call it historically a collaborative effort between a bunch of people. Future VLE, VLE stands for Virtual Learning Environment, it's British, right? And the future VLE is your interaction, you, your computer screen, the tool that you use. And then surrounding that are the connections to all the different types of resources, educational experiences, whatever, that are out there. If you look, for example, in the lower right-hand corner, you see something called Flickr, which is a place where people upload their photographs. There could be another bubble, YouTube, which would be those videos. There's a link upper left to LiveJournal. LiveJournal is a blogging environment where people create their own blogs. 43 things as a list manager. And the thing is, also, others of these bubbles are educational resources. If you look on the left-hand side there, LearnDirect resources, personal hosting, your own resources for things that you've created, commercial resources. Any sort of educational material connects into this network. Now, if you think about how you're currently thinking of learning, think about how this changes things. Right now, a student goes to you and takes one of your courses. In the future, some educational material that you provide, maybe, will in some way, shape, or form go to the student, where it will be not the whole of that student's learning experience, but just a part of it. And it will be something that's not merely consumed, but something rather that becomes part of the dialogue in this language that the student is using to communicate with everyone else. I know that last bit was a bit of a mouthful, but traditional online learning, traditional continuing education, if you will, is institution-based. You're all working, representing, doing things for your institution. Your online courses, the learning management system, you log into the University of Alberta learning management system. Even if you're talking about how you're distributing your online content, it's all been content federations, closed, locked up, authenticated entry types of access to materials. It's product-based. You have course packages, course materials, CD-ROM delivery. That's all those vendors out there. And so things like digital rights and authentication and blood types in your first form become very important. It's content-based. Right, isn't it? It's like that heavy text. You're presenting people with text and images rather than networks of connected concepts. It's designed, it's sequenced. You go through it. I was at a talk yesterday, and the person was talking about the best practices in continuing education. He used the analogy of a bus system. He said, we're like the bus line, and the students are like the passengers, and we have to do most of the work. He said, we have to design these bus routes. And I'm sitting there in the back of the room, because I always sit in the back of the room, and I'm thinking, no, that's just backwards. We don't put students on buses all in groups of 55 or whatever, all going to the same place and getting off at arranged stops 10 blocks from their destination. We put them on bicycles and they go where they want to go. Kind of like what we lived yesterday, except with less chaos. What we're getting in place of that are learning networks. Learning networks are not institution-based. They're resource-based. Not even resource-based, they're more like interaction-based, where resources are out there and you grab a resource, you pull it in, you rework it, you repurpose it, you mash it up, and then you fling it out and it becomes something that you've created, and that becomes another educational resource. I talk a lot about student-generated educational resources, and I have argued in various fora that we should stop producing educational resources. We should certainly stop paying publishers for educational resources, because we have a staff of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, our students, who can create perfectly good educational resources themselves and would like to do it, especially if it saves them $100 a pop on a textbook. Not product-based. It's not the packaging and presentation of content, but rather the moving of content through this network, like electricity through a grid, like water through a plumbing system, where this material is just brought together and presented on an as-needed basis. It's not content-based. It's participation in one of these cultures, one of these communities. Learning becomes a part of identity formation. The principles, the semantical principles that describe how knowledge can take form in this kind of environment, I cast under the heading of connective knowledge. I'm not able to discuss the epistemology of connective knowledge in any detail in this forum, but I will identify what can be stated to be four major principles of successful networks, and therefore principles of connective knowledge. Autonomy, where students have choice and control over what material they're learning, over the sequence, the way a person who is exploring a city can choose what destination that they want to go on. And they can choose a guided tour, they can choose a bus, they can choose a car, but the idea here is that they have that choice. Diversity, different culture, different points of view. Diversity isn't, like people doing ethnic dances and things like that. Diversity is people being able to express themselves. Just like I talked about with the blog earlier, where the blog is a presentation not just of some sort of factual content, but also something about the source of that content, something about myself. Diversity is people being able to be their own individuals and to express that individuality and to express whatever affiliations they may have. Diversity is not just about people, it's also about technology. It's about, yes, even being allowed to use Windows, even being allowed to use Apple computers. openness. I've talked a lot about open. It was mentioned in the introduction. I can't say a whole lot about it here. But what makes a network work is openness. The capacity to feed a message forward, the capacity to retrieve a message from another source. Openness, this open and free exchange of information, is what makes these communities possible. You think about it, the first thing that you want to do if you want to repress or control a society is you cut down on the flow of information. You prohibit the transfer of information. You crack down on things like freedom of speech, freedom of the press. The same principle operates in networks. And then finally, interaction. The capacity to connect to each other, to create communities, to inquire, to assert. In your work, the applications of this are almost endless. And I picked this list of properties of best practices for continuing education from a presentation from yesterday. And I just sort of snagged it. And I'm sorry, I don't have the credit there, but I took my notes down so fast I didn't write down the source. So if anyone knows it, I'll put the proper credit there. It was the talk just after the opening keynote. But think about your own practices. Think about outreach, for example. How outreach used to be, you create some posters or whatever, and you present them, and you know you have your catalog, you have your posters, you have your advertisements on television. Outreach now becomes much more of an interaction with the community. It becomes, indeed, if you read things like the Clue Train Manifesto, the community working with you in order to decide for itself what educational opportunities will be presented. Financing relates to openness. Assessment, there's a large move from tests to portfolios and the presentation of your own work as an instance of yourself. And so on. I won't read through that whole list. As you worked through the different things that you do in your own environments, in your own institutions, where what you're trying to do right now is to provide learning to students, these four principles that I mentioned, autonomy, openness, interaction, and diversity, will come into play at every point, where you make decisions about funding programs or public relations or student support, where you're looking at the sorts of technology that you want to buy in order to support your online offerings. And given what I've said, if you accept what I've said as being possibly true, then these four principles will offer you a guide as to the approach that you should be taking. If you're looking at a piece of technology, you ask, is it open? Can people add their content, or can people read the content from it? Does it allow diversity? Does it allow interaction? Yes, these sorts of questions. And these principles need to guide the sort of work that you're doing, because you're in an environment now, as I mentioned, where the students are moving from people who simply consume stuff to people who do things for themselves. And that means that you, as providers of learning resources and learning opportunities, your role is changing as well, because you are moving from being people who provide things for people to being people who help people provide things for themselves. And that is going to be a fundamental underlying change in your business model. And that's my talk. And I thank you very much for coming to it. And I'd certainly be happy to entertain any questions. I don't know how much time we have, because I kind of lost track. I'm sorry. I'm good? So I guess I do have time for questions. I'm just shout really loud. I'm recording off of this.
Well, you may have to repeat it. My question has to do with what I'm sure you're going to cringe at, the question of cost pricing. A lot of what we would have to deal with if we want to try to create web portals becomes, in your description, reflections of ourselves as instructors, but also reflections of the community of students who interact with one another and with the instructor online. But we're going to want to use resources. We're going to need to find material that are going to serve as focal points for instruction. we're going to be tempted to pull from here and here and here and say, yeah, here's a good image that will help represent or explain something. And for example, you're saying that you're going to be putting this presentation available for us online, and I'm wondering if all the photos that you have in this particular image would all be in this particular website that are now going to be available to the world. Is this PowerPoint, for example, have images that are all copyright clear? Do you have permissions for all these images? Because this is something we face all the time. And while we may not like the idea, and we would love everything to be open and free and let everyone do what they want with information, how do you address the reality that there are copyright laws and we all have, as university employees, follow them?
Okay, yeah, the question addressed the question of copyright and how we address that reality. And it is a reality because there are thugs who will come in. No, I'm just kidding. I was thinking of the recording industry there. The images in my presentation, I checked and I used Creative Commons licensed images. That's why you saw so many things off of Flickr on there. And images that I knew I had permission to use. I think I did that with most of them. I certainly do recall checking for Creative Commons logos. It's a pain, frankly. This whole copyright thing is a case where openness is being curtailed by laws that were designed for a different type of technology, by laws that were designed in days when content was owned, and we're moving to a new environment. I think that what you describe now is what I would call a transition phenomenon. We're going from old to new. And what is going to happen, what we're beginning to see happen more and more, is that the materials that we want to use in our educational resources will be available for free. Will be available with rights for reuse. For example, I mentioned Creative Commons. I'm not sure how many of you know of Creative Commons. It's a type of licensing that you can use instead of a traditional copyright, all rights reserved. If you license your content with Creative Commons, what you are doing is giving other people the right to use your material. And there are sometimes conditions attached to that, as the slogan for Creative Commons goes, some rights are reserved. For example, the Creative Commons license that I use is a by non-commercial share alike license. And what that means is that you can use my material for whatever you want. So my slides, go for it. But you have to give me credit because I created them. And you can't use it commercially because I don't want you to be selling my stuff, because then you'll turn around and try to tell me not to distribute it. I'm a bit paranoid that way. That's my call. And share alike, which means that if you use my stuff, then you need to share it under the same license that I've offered my stuff. This kind of license, a Creative Commons license for content, is very similar to some open source licenses for software. And these kind of licenses, and there's a range of them, allow materials to be shared freely. Now, there's a lot of roadblocks. One roadblock is finding this stuff. But now both Google and Yahoo have Creative Commons searches. Another roadblock is the production of this material. The material that all of you people create, material which I might add is for the most part paid for by the government and therefore the people of Canada, is all copyrighted. And if you're publishing papers, you're probably publishing papers in an academic journal and handing that copyright over to the publisher and then paying the publisher for the right to read the stuff that you just created. In the future, more and more, we are going to see the production of material in the academic sphere, and especially that which is produced by virtue of public funding, to be released under one of these open licenses, to be released under what they call open access. And so we are seeing more and more online journals providing free and open access to educational content. The Public Library of Science, for example, is one such journal. The Open Archives Initiative is a type of software that allows people to upload and distribute for free access this kind of content. So as time goes by, we are seeing more and more content created by students and by educators with the explicit intent of free sharing. And as that happens, the problem, and I'll say it no other way, it's a problem. It's a huge barrier to learning of copyright and publisher restrictions will go away. It's just like in music. There's a thing out there called the PodSafe Music Network. And what that is a place where you can go get music created by independent artists that you are allowed to use in your own podcast. You're allowed to distribute it. And they won't block you. They won't encumber the music with digital rights management or anything like that. Because people are understanding that the music publishers won't play ball. They won't allow this music to be distributed. So they're creating this network of free and open music and doing an end run around the locked down content. And eventually, you'll see your top 10 songs coming from the PodSafe Music Network and not from the traditional publishers. That's the answer to the copyright question. Or my view of it, anyways. I know it was kind of long-winded, I'm sorry. Any other questions or comments?
When you showed the slide of the virtual learning environment, all the little bubbles going on to various resources, and the idea being that you're going to just pull these in and synthesize them and make some education of that, it got me very excited. But then, almost immediately, I thought of adult students that I have, and we said, go to www.down.ca, wouldn't know where to type that into the browser. How do you picture pulling those two together? How do you picture taking the people that are looking at the internet, you know, miles away from them and speeding away? You know, how do you figure getting everybody caught up to this point?
Okay. Here's where I want to go to the, excuse me? Remember that site that I mentioned? I want to go there now. How's that for planning? You have an application that may or may not start up automatically. It's as easy to start up, certainly, as your web browser. It might be a web page. It might be standalone. And he's just going to type. You just need to go get the browser up and then the down.ca/editor/writer.htm, that link. So we'll just go anywhere online and then just type in that URL. Yeah, good. Normally I just go, because I've memorized it. Of course, it is my own website. So. Now, what you're going to see here is what I've called RSS Writer. Writer without an E, because that's the new style, and I'm trying to be hip and cool. Okay, it's a joke. And what the RSS Writer does, and we'll see it here in just a second. Now, this is in development, and this is Internet Explorer, so it's not going to look great. But there it is. And the idea is that this is a system that does all of that stuff that you described for you. Now, let's back up. All right, he went a bit ahead of me there. Now, don't hit submit, please. That won't work. Hit the drop down for Stevenson. You see that drop down there? It's easier when I do it. That's a bunch of different sources, different feed from different types of resources. Now, this My Glue Test, which he's going to hit here, that is an application. It's about this much code that runs on my website. And what it does is it automatically pulls together a bunch of different resources. And I don't know why. No, don't hit submit. I know what you're going to have to do. Reload the page, please. It's cached. Well, we had it. All right. Hit the drop down again, but go to a different link. Go to, yeah, sure. Okay. Now go to, don't hit some. Now hit the My Glue test, please. Right. There we go. Excellent. Now, if we scroll down in that a little bit, on that left-hand column. I don't know if we can. No, okay, just highlight some text, please, and then drag and drop it into that yellow area. Maybe not that much text, but okay, doesn't matter. Well, I guess it does matter. This is an interesting thing to watch because, of course, we're using, I don't know why it's all highlighting like that. Just for the record, this works beautifully in Firefox. I have no idea. Why would it highlight the entire page? Anyhow, okay, forget that. Pretend we've dragged and dropped that hello in there. Just click on the yellow, and you can start typing. Anyhow, the idea here, and it really does work better in Firefox. Normally, I use my own computer, so all my demos are, like, you know, fixed. No, I'm just kidding. But the idea is, on the left-hand side is the set of resources that is aggregated by the aggregator. And when this is working properly, that is to say, when people are using Firefox, you just drag and drop the resource into that editing window. And then you do whatever you want in the editing window. And then down there, the form, I hate this a lot, thanks. that form down there allows you to upload it to any of those external bubbles. Like right now I've got it set so that it uploads to Blogger. So you fill out the form with the name of your blog and it uploads it to Blogger. Right now that's not going to work. Oh, there's an image. I don't know if you can drag that image or not. Why didn't that show up before? Well, yeah. It just won't let you drag and drop. Wonder why. Yeah. That's sort of strange. Anyhow, the point is, how are people going to do this was the question. Something like this, except that works better, something that's created by a professional programmer as opposed to me, will be a tool that allows people to do this. There we go. It dragged and dropped. And you know, like right now, our learning management systems, to a large degree, are enabling the consumption of content. But these new personal learning environments will not only aggregate these resources from all over the internet, they will aggregate but also give you, create for you, an authoring environment so that you're just dragging and dropping stuff right in there and then doing whatever you want. I've got, like, those are aggregating RSS feeds, but if you can also imagine it aggregating Creative Commons searches from Google and Yahoo, you can also imagine it being able to conduct a search on Wikipedia, so in the left-hand column, the Wikipedia article shows up. This kind of combination of authoring and content consumption, this is something that's very definitely coming. In the Microsoft world will do this by creating access to resources through your authoring environments like MS Word. You'll be able to access articles, dictionary articles, encyclopedia articles, things like that, directly through an interface in MS Word. That will be the commercial proprietary way of doing it. But more likely, especially for education, an open system like this where we're accessing free and open resources will be what we can do here. Again, long-winded. I expected that demo to go a bit more smoothly. But you can see why I didn't make the demo part of the main talk. Anything else?
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, everyone.